Brothers in the Dhamma, that was an invocation to Padmasambhava, not to Minarepa. It can be translated as hung to the northwest of the land of Urgyen on the calyx of a lotus flower. O wondrous, the highest city has been attained. Thus Padmasambhava declares, O thou who art encircled with an entourage of darkenings, following thy example will I work. Thou must come here to give me thy blessing. That's the translation that Bandhu did with Dada Rinpoche. And I've started with it because it occurred to me that in a way there's something missing from this retreat and this presentation of Milarepa, and it's singing. That's what's missing, and it will be missing. I don't think I've even read a Milarepa song yet, and I don't even know if we'll get one today. And of course that's a huge gap, because Milarepa taught his Dhamma, his teaching, so much through singing. The life of Milarepa, the 100,000 songs of Milarepa, the Milakarbhum, it's all song. There are also teachings. He can do discourses. He can also do intimate meditational instruction. But his preferred method of communicating the Dharma is through singing, which, of course, we don't really do at all in the West. People sort of dabble a bit in poetry, but singing these wonderful songs doesn't come into it. Milarepa comes out of this tradition, which really comes from India and no doubt blends with Tibetan folk traditions. The Indian tradition is what's called the Doha, which is a particular form of verse and singing which comes out of the great Mahasiddhas, Saraha and Naropa and Tilopa and Milarepa's teacher Marpa. So many of them, the great Indian siddhas, sang their teaching. And that flowed into Tibet and really sort of took off. I mean, it does seem as though as well that the Milarepa singing tradition sort of grew after Milarepa's death, after his parinirvana, after his passing away, that perhaps more songs were added to the corpus. Many, many years ago, when I was first getting into the Dharma, when I was still living at home, for about 16 or 17, I managed to get hold of some of those LPs that were in the non-such Lyricord series. I forget the name of the man who collected the music, a very, very great musicologist who went to Tibet. And on one of them, you had the usual Tibetan orchestras with the deep chanting and the great trumpets and so on. But on one of them there was the song of what was known called a Manip, short for Mani Padme Hum, just a kind of wandering beggar, not necessarily any great lama, and he was singing a Milarepa song. So moving. I've tried to track down that particular album. Long ago I sold my record collection, I think to fund me going on retreat probably. But so moving, hearing this old man just sing this Milarepa song, to anybody who would listen, or just singing it for the sake of singing it. So we need to keep that in mind with all this, that I am being very prosaic in presenting Milarepa to you, but and that doesn't really do justice to this stream of inspiration. I mean, Milarepa, no doubt because of his tantric practice and his own innate ability. You know, he's completely freed up his speech chakra. His chakras are all open, and the speech chakra can just pour out a song, inspired song. You know, you can even go, you can say this goes back to even perhaps the Buddha himself with the udanas that the Buddha, you know, gives forth under the force of tremendous inspiration, the upward moving breath, which is not the out breath, it's the udana, it's a particular one of the five breaths, the breath that comes up and out under the pressure of tremendous inspiration. So Milarepa is in that tradition. So we're missing something. So I wanted to acknowledge that, you know, before going any further, and just make a contribution by not exactly singing a song, but chanting an invocation. So yesterday, coming back now to the prosaic, yesterday Milarepa had received initiation from Marpa. He got his heart's desire, and we had the reading in the puja in the evening. It was very, very good to hear that laid out. He went for refuge. He has a vision. Marpa points to the mandala of this particular tantric deity, Chakrasangvara. And immediately he goes into retreat. As soon as he's got the oral instructions, as soon as he's got the initiations, as soon as he commits himself, he's immediately into an 11-month retreat. The training doesn't end. The training changes. It's very, very interesting to look at this in the life of Milarepa. The training before initiation and, well, in a sense, ordination, before going for refuge, is very much to do with purification. Very, very much to do with dealing with past karma. And being, you know, Marpa explains why he's put him through so much trial and tribulation. It's to purify, so he can actually then do something, can actually get on with things. The training after ordination is immediately intensive meditation. So there's no, it's not that you get initiated, and it's not that you get ordained, and that's it, that you've arrived. Unfortunately, this can affect people. We can be the other way in our own movement. Yes, people make quite a lot of effort to get ordained, and then after ordination, they go to sleep. Sorry to be so blunt, and I'm sure that's not true of any of the order members here. But it can happen. People can think that they've arrived now. They've got the kesa, they've got the name, yippee, let's party. I'm probably overstating this. But I'm sure if anybody listens to this on Free Buddhist Audio, they'll write me stinking emails and tell me that I've got it all wrong. But there is some truth in it. I've certainly seen it. You know, before ordination, everybody wants to see you on the ordination team. Everybody, you know, all of you want to see me, or find that somebody's preceptor, they want to see me all the time. After ordination, very, very quiet. Very, very quiet. And I'm sure people are thinking they're doing it because they know how busy I am. No, not true, is it? They've got what they want. God, this is terrible. It sounded terribly cynical. But it's human nature. This is what can happen. This is what can happen. So easy to do. You know, you find people, they don't come on their post-ordination retreats. They don't think of coming and going to refuge retreats anymore, as if they've done that, they've been there. What they actually do, I'm not quite sure. Maybe they're doing other retreats that I don't hear about. Maybe they get very involved in working in their centre. But they definitely, it can be a definite, sort of in a sense, slowing down. Milarepa is saying, no, you intensify. After initiation and ordination, you intensify. This is just the beginning. Ordination is just the start. It's not the end. It's the entrance into something. It's time to really push on and really crack on while you've got the time. So keep that in your mind, those of you who are preparing for ordination. Remind yourself, think, really fix this in your mind, that after ordination, I'm going to make more effort. It's a different kind of effort because you've got new practices. You've got to get used to being a new person. You've got a new name. You've got a new set of precepts. But all the more reason to, you know, to make more effort after ordination. Very quickly after my own ordination, I went on solitary retreat almost immediately afterwards because I wanted to really make the most of the new practice that I'd been given, and that's a very good thing to do. And certainly the 4-month ordination course, which really I'd recommend everybody to go on, sometimes there are exceptions, but it's much better to think in terms of going on the 4-month course. We've changed the pattern of that course in recent years so that you're ordained quite early on that, and then afterwards it's an intensive retreat, so you're practicing as order members, and it's as if it's to make the point, it was Maitreya Bundu who really had an insight into this, to make the point, look, it's time to practice after ordination. It's time to really get down to, down to something. Yes, you've been getting down to something beforehand, but afterwards, don't think, oh, we've arrived, we can coast along, we've got a status now, because there is a kind of status that goes with an order member if you're not careful. But it's actually a time to really engage very fully with the Dharmacharya. So Milarepa goes into an 11-month intensive meditation retreat. And for these Karmakagyu, well, it's not Karmakagyu, it's Marpakagyu, the Kagyu tradition, these meditators, all the great tradition, a meditation retreat is pretty much meditating most of the time. Walled up in a cave, he would have been walled up by Marpa and his wife, there would have been rituals for that. He would have had food in there, and he would just be getting on with it. I think it says in the life story that he places a butter lamp on his head, on the crown of his head, and isn't going to move until the butter lamp goes out. I presume that means for each session of meditation rather than the whole 11 months. So that means he's really not moving. He's not shuffling around like I do. I'm not recommending you do that. There'd probably be health and safety issues if you do that. So don't do that. But anyway, he's in retreat. After 11 months, he emerges. He comes out. It's time to come out of retreat. And the first thing he does is go to Marpa and Dharmema, Marpa's wife, and he performs puja in their presence. He performs a sevenfold puja to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, but to Marpa and to Dharmema. It's interesting, just say a word about Dharmema. Dharmema is the Tibetan translation of the Sanskrit nairatmya, which means selflessness. And nairatmya is the consort of a tantric deity named Hivadra, and that was Marpa's main practice. So there's a kind of symbolism, you know, going on here that yes, it's all very down to earth with Marpa and his family, but Milarepa is seeing deeper than that. There's something else going on. They're transmitting as well, if you like, the mythic context in our terms of Buddhahood. So he performs a puja to them. And then Marpa asks the question, like any great teacher would, you've been in retreat for 11 months, what have you understood? What have you understood? It's a very interesting question, this. Not what was your experience, what have you understood? What do you know? What do you know? I say this, it's not that Milarepa doesn't experience, he most certainly does. But I find it interesting that I don't know what the Tibetan is and whether you could translate it in other ways, but this more recent, probably very reliable translation, what have you understood? What do you know? I say this because I think there's an obsession with experience in the modern world, and certainly in Buddhism, and as in contradiction to understanding. So people often want to talk about their experience, but they don't really want to talk about what they understand the Dharma to be. I was having a conversation with somebody recently about this, and she was saying, well, I want to experience. I said, yeah, but you need to understand what the Dharma is. You know, experience is to a penny. You can have any kind of experience you like, But unless you understand it in dharmic terms, it's useless. It's completely useless. It doesn't mean anything. The experiences you want to have must be informed by the Dharma. So this is very, very important. Marpa, who's very concerned with direct realization and insight into the nature of things, he wants to know what Milarepa has understood. And Milarepa tells him. So I'll just read bits from this very, very interesting section, often not paid attention to. The person who drew my attention to this many, many years ago, in 1980, I think, in Bodh Gaya, was Robert Thurman. Before Robert Thurman was famous, he was giving a lecture at a school in Bodh Gaya. And he was giving a lecture, a very interesting lecture, on the union of the sutras and the tantras. This is a particular concern of the Geluk school. And he was very concerned that, again, you get lots of people into the tantra, into experience, and they neglect basic Buddhism. They neglect basic understanding. And he was citing this particular passage because, yes, Milarepa is the great archetypal tantric yogin concerned with the direct taste of Mahamudra and the union of bliss and emptiness and the six yogas of Naropa and all the rest of it. But listen to what he says. This is Milarepa to Marpa. I have understood that due to the fundamental condition of ignorance, the body comprised of flesh and blood fully formed, together with its perceiving consciousness, initially coalesce through the 12 links of dependent origination, formations, and so forth. For those with merit who desire liberation, it is a ferry to a future life of freedoms and endowments. For those with evil karma who amass sinful deeds, it is a guide leading to the lower realms. This is truly a decisive moment, the boundary between journeying up or down, and one that determines the profit or loss, leading to lasting good or lasting evil. Moreover, relying upon your power as Lord and guide of beings, Marpa, I seek release from the ocean of life's round, the source of all suffering so difficult to escape. I first sought refuge in the teacher and the three jewels, and then trained properly in the discipline. I have understood that in such a context, the source of all goodness and happiness is the teacher. Therefore, the primary and essential point is to follow whatever he commands and to maintain the sacred commitments purely. Then, intensively contemplating the difficulty of attaining the freedoms and endowments of a human rebirth, death and impermanence, the causes and effects of actions, and the faults of life's round, one is overwhelmed by the desire for liberation from life's round. One should then rely on the appropriate vows of individual liberation, which are like the foundation. Upon such a basis, one gradually ascends through the spiritual stages, guarding as closely as one's eyes the disciplines they describe. If transgressed, the vows must be restored. But this is not enough. One must develop the desire to free all sentient beings from life's round in its entirety by generating the bodhicitta. With love and compassion, everything one does is dedicated to the benefit of others. Then one sets out in search of the selflessness of persons, employing numerous examples and reasons drawn from both scripture and logic, and so on and so forth. That last bit, employing numerous examples and reasons drawn from both scripture and logic. So the point I want to make here is that Milarepa, the great yogi, is absolutely grounded in basic Dharma, which he has understood. That is the product of his meditation retreat. He goes on to talk about shunyata meditation, building up shamatha, serenity meditation, calming meditation, vipassana, insight or wisdom meditation, talks about having the visionary experiences to do with meditating on different deities, different bodhisattvas. And it's all framed in working for the good of all sentient beings. So this is, I think, a really remarkable passage. You know, that when people, and it sometimes happens, people say that they have realization, that they have insight, we must ask them, and we must ask ourselves, is it into the Dharma? Is it really founded on the Dharma? Or is it something, as it were, made up out of your own or somebody else's personal experience? This is very, very important. Milarepa does seem to have actually done some study as well with Marpa of some kind or another. He's heard the Buddha Dharma. He's reflected on the Buddha Dharma. He's made that Buddha Dharma a living experience. So it's very, very important that we take this into account. What we're trying to do with our Buddhist training, our Buddhist practice, is to mould ourselves, to be reformed by the Dharma itself, not just purely from our internal experience. We must open and open and open to what the teachings have to say. So the first thing that is particularly striking about Milarepa's understanding is that he understands how this body has come about, how this human embodiment has come about. It's come about through the 12 links of dependent origination. It's arisen out of primordial ignorance. In dependence upon ignorance arises the karma formations, the samskaras. Independence upon samskaras arises consciousness. Independence upon consciousness arises name and form. Independence upon name and form, etc. The wheel of life, that's what he's talking about. That's the first thing he says. I've come into this embodiment through the activity of Pratityasamutpada, through dependent origination. This is really absolutely fundamental basic Buddhism. You don't know anything about Buddhism unless you know Pratityasamutpada. You don't know anything about Buddhism at all unless you know the 12 Nidanas. And of course Bhante has also added the positive Nidanas based on the Buddha's teaching, so you've got a proper equilibrium. But it's really important that we get hold of this teaching. This is why we have the Transcendental Principle Retreat, the Survey of Buddhism Retreat. It's not fashionable to meditate on this. It's not fashionable. It's the last thing that anybody wants to do. But believe me, if you really study the 12 Nidanas, the cyclic Nidanas and the spiral Nidanas, with somebody who really understands them, not just understands them, but has a real feeling for them, you will find it liberating. It explains so much. It explains so much of what we're up against. You know, that we've come into this life, we're driven by forces coming out of primordial ignorance. I know some people have problems with previous lives. We don't even need to think about that. The fact is, we don't know why we're here. That's the nature of ignorance. Heidegger talks about being thrown, doesn't he? That human existence is being thrown. You just have this sense of being thrown into existence. That's the sort of, you know, his existentialist sort of vision of life. It can almost feel arbitrary. Well, that's unknowing. Avidya. Avidya. We don't know. We don't have that higher, deeper perspective. And the beginning of, the real beginning of wisdom is knowing that we don't know. We really do not have a clue. I think one of the most sort of terrible things about contemporary Buddhism is people thinking they know because they've read a bit of Buddhism. They've read about the Lakshanas. It's sort of easy to see that, oh yeah, everything's changing. Yeah, I don't really have a self. Yeah, life sucks. It's painful. But that's an intellectual understanding. It's not actually knowing, tasting directly what's happening. If it was, there'd be real change, real transformation if you were really seeing that. So one of the things we're going to have to get to grips with, first of all, is our unknowing. Own our unknowing. And when you meditate on the Nidana chain, and I've done a fair bit of meditation on the Nidana chain, you can start to wake up to the fact that I am blind. And so many of my actions and behaviours are coming out of complete unknowing. Complete unknowing. I have no idea of what I'm doing. Bhante likens in the survey the relationship between avidya and the sanskara as the relationship between a drunk man and the irrational actions he performs. You know that when you're those terrible things, you know, when one was younger, hopefully younger, and somebody tells you what you were doing the night before when you were under the influence. You have no memory of it. You can't believe it. So it's so crazy. But the thing is, that is what it's like when you don't know reality, when you're ignorant of the way things are. You know, that's what it's like. We're doing things blindly, having all sorts of effects and impacts. We have no idea of their consequences. This is the great tragedy of life, isn't it? The great sort of tragedy of existence, that our unknowing creates so much suffering, and our unknowing gets us into so many terrible circumstances. And this is why you can see the bodhisattvas have so much compassion. Why there is so much compassion, because that is the great tragedy. I didn't know, and yet you're reaping the consequences of your actions. I remember seeing a performance of Jean Cocteau, Stravinsky's Oedipus Rex. Cocteau did the libretto for that, which was translated into Latin for some reason. But I remember this scene, the last scene, where there's this figure with these black eyes, black blood coming from their eyes. And it's this moment where Oedipus is realising that, you know, what has happened. You know, he's killed his father, he's had sex with his mother, I think that's the way it is, isn't it? And there's this black blood, and this realization of unknowing has led to this terrible suffering, this terrible tragedy. And of course there is a sort of moment in that of weird catharsis and purification. So we need to wake up to our ignorance, and we expose our ignorance by meditating on the Dharma. You know, wrong view is exposed by right view. There's a bit of a concern I have as well, that you know, again, there's a sort of, you know, people get very excited by, you know, really sort of, you know, contemporary intellectuals who are sort of fighting against or, you know, some of the sort of pervading ideologies of the day. Well, that can be very, very good, but it's not necessarily right view. You only really expose wrong view in the Buddhist definition of the term by dwelling on right view, perfect vision, really knowing the Dharma, really knowing Pratichasamutpada, really knowing the Lakshanas, insisting all the time on meditating on a Buddhist perspective on life, and bringing that to everything that you do. It's the only way that you can see your nescience, your unknowing. So this is the first thing that he talks about. Real insight into the 12 Nidanas and how it's brought him here. And this incredible, you can tell it's insight because it's simple. Insight isn't complicated. If it's complicated, it's not. It's not seeing things as they are. For those with merit who desire liberation, the human body is a ferry to a future life of freedoms and endowments. For those with evil karma who amass sinful deeds, it is a guide leading to the lower realms. This is our human embodiment. He doesn't mean body simply in the physical sense. He means the whole psychophysical manifestation. That's what the body is. Then this wonderful, incredible line, is worth imprinting in consciousness, really engraving on the heart. This is the truly decisive moment, the boundary between journeying up or down, the one that determines the profit or loss, leading to lasting good or lasting evil. So the human life, the human embodiment, is the truly decisive moment, the boundary between journeying up or down. This is an amazing insight into human life. The precious human life, as it's called in Tibetan Buddhism, is the Sanskrit for it, the human life, is kshana. Kshana. But kshana also means a moment. The human life is a moment. It's this moment. And this moment is the decisive moment. This moment is the boundary. We are at a boundary. We are a sort of hinterland between journeying up or down. This is us now, in this very moment, in this very life. It's going to determine whether or not we're going to make progress on the path, whether we're going to really fulfill our potential as human beings, or whether we're going to just keep going round the same old habits, or even go down deeper into samsara. It's an incredible way to see human life. In the Nyingma tradition, you have the notion of the six bardos, and the first bardo is the bardo of life, the bardo of the human life. Oh, now, when the bardo of life upon me is dawning, abandoning idleness, there being no idleness in a devotee's life, entering into the reality undistractedly, entering into the reality undistractedly, listening, reflecting, and meditating. That's living the Buddha's life, listening, reflecting, and meditating, carrying on to the path knowledge of the true nature of appearances of mind and of mind. May the tree kaya, Buddhahood in body, speech, and mind, be realized. Once that the human form has been attained, may there be no time or opportunity in which to idle it away. So this human life is this boundary between going up and down. I find this a very, very powerful way of speaking. You know, we are in this moment of tremendous possibility and potential. And Milarepa goes further. He talks about his devotion to his teacher. His teacher has, well, really given him the blessings to make the most of this human life. He talks about going for refuge, committing himself to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And then he talks about intensively meditating on the four thoughts that turn the mind to the Dharma. So I want to, you know, dwell on this. And of course, the first of these is this precious human life, recognizing what this precious human life really is. We really don't meditate on this nearly enough, I don't think. I think it's a very important reflection that comes out of general Buddhist tradition, but is very, very strong in Tibetan Buddhism. You find it again and again and again. These four thoughts that turn the mind to the Dharma, the first being this precious human life. And they say that you need to be grounded in these four reflections to really motivate yourself to practice the Dharma. And I think the precious human life is an important reflection because so many, it seems, in the world, for different reasons, but particularly you come across it in the West, people have such a low opinion of themselves. People often say that they have difficulty with the metta-bhavana because they don't really like themselves, they have problems thinking well of themselves, and so on and so forth. This comes up again and again and again. Of course, in India with our brothers and sisters there, because of the background of the tremendous social inequality that people coming out being treated, you know, even though you've got different, you're not allowed to use this language, but being treated as untouchables. You've also got, again, very low levels of confidence, I think I'm right in saying, Vivekaratna and so on. So the notion, though, of the precious human life cuts through this. It cuts through these issues, I think. It really does. You know, very often we have all sorts of, there are all sorts of reasons why we have a poor or a low, goodness, or a low self-view of ourselves. And why we don't feel confident, why we don't think we can make progress. In a sense, the Buddha, Milarepa, the tradition, is not interested in any of that. Not interested in any of that. The fact is, we are human beings. The fact is, we have a precious human life. We have functioning senses. We have a mind. We have an incredible mind, actually. I know some of us might not think that we've got a very good mind, but actually we've got this incredible mind. We've got this mind that is able to reflect on experience. We're not just instinctive. We don't just react to stimuli and then, you know, react in such a way that causes harm to other people. We can actually, if you like, extract ourselves from experience. So we don't have to be instinctive. That means that we can be moral. That means that we can be ethical. We've got that basic sense of a basic kind of ethical potential because we're human beings. We're not locked into just instinctive reactions. We can put a gap in it. Somebody says something to us that's a bit harsh or a bit insensitive or whatever it may be. We don't have to respond we don't have to retaliate. We can put a check in there and think, oh no, we don't need to do that. We don't need to be vengeful in relation to this. We can act in a different way in relation to this. We can be creative. You know, Bhante's reactive mind, creative mind. We have that ability because we've got a mind that can reflect, this reflexive consciousness, which is extraordinarily precious. And actually is even more profound than that. It's not just this reflexive consciousness. It's a consciousness that actually can have a vision beyond itself. It's very, very often when you get expositions of the precious human existence in Tibetan Buddhist texts, they very soon start talking about Shraddha, faith. It's very interesting that the real human condition is a condition of Shraddha. Not of cynicism, but of Shraddha. That there's something in human beings that resonates with what lies beyond, that resonates with the Buddha. There's something in us that, as Nagasena, the great Theravadin Arahant said, there's something in us that can leap beyond, that can actually intuit a state of Buddhahood, that can intuit wisdom and compassion and can resonate with it, that can lift us up out of our present state. So we need to meditate on this precious human existence. We've all got it. If you go around consistently thinking you're a bad person, and you just give into that, you've got to do some serious work on yourself. Maybe therapy will help, I'm not sure. Not always convinced, having friends of mine who've been in therapy for decades. And I've had to say to them sometimes, you know, why don't you try Buddhism? I'm talking about order members. Why don't you try the Dharma? Why don't you try the Dharma? Because therapy isn't working. Come on. I'm a bit shocked by that. But I haven't tried the Dharma. You need to really look into yourself. If you feel bad about yourself, you're sitting there doing the first stage of the Metta-bhavana. It's not a problem for me. I love the first stage of the Metta-bhavana. I don't know if that's because I'm a massive egotist, but I really enjoy it. I find it very, very pleasurable. But anyway, we won't dwell on my rampant egotism. But if you're sitting there and you're feeling bad, why? Have you done something bad? You know, look at yourself. What have you done the night before, the day before, to make you feel bad? If you haven't, well, that's irrational. That's a bad habit. Look at what you've done the day before. Have you spoken well to people? Have you been kind to people? Have you lived ethically? And if you have, relax, rejoice. There's nothing to feel bad about. You can dwell in that clear conscience. Clear conscience is regarded as very, very important by the Buddha, by Buddhist tradition, and you're encouraged to dwell in it. This is sort of self-rejoicing. It's very important, but it's not. But it's intelligent. It's not just, oh, I'm a lovely person, and I need to be kind to myself. And you're not actually engaging with your life. Look, have you behaved well? If you have, rejoice. Dwell in that. And the result will be happiness. The result will be well-being. See the effects of your skillful actions positively. If, however, you feel bad and you look and you say, actually, I've done this and I've done that and I've done the other, well, then you need to put it right. In the meditation itself, you have to sort of, you can just confess it, if you like, in your mind to the Buddha. Maybe, and afterwards, maybe you've got to go and confess it to spiritual friends. You've probably also got to go and put it right with the people that you've harmed. You can do something. You can do something. So it's not sort of good enough to just think that, oh, I don't like myself, and not do anything about it. You have to do something. And it might be that you're just not recognising the skillfulness that you do. Very often that's the case. Very often when I talk to people with these problems, they are not recognising their goodness. And they're not therefore confident in their goodness. And they need to be more confident in their goodness. There are other things as well to do with not feeling good about yourself, not waking up to precious human, the preciousness of human life. Maybe you're not taking care of yourself well enough physically. Maybe you're overeating. Maybe you're watching too much television. Maybe you're just distracting yourself. Maybe you're not living meaningfully enough. You know, if we want to feel good about ourselves, waking up to our precious human life, we have to live meaningfully. We have to live well. You know, if you haven't really been living according to your values, then you know what those values are, then don't be surprised if you feel terrible. Of course you will. Actions have consequences. What you dwell on is what you become. So there are things you can do to wake up to this very, very precious, you know, human existence. And of course, the Metta Bhavana is wonderful because you're not just waking up to your own precious human existence, you're waking up to the precious human existence of all other people. This is very important, and it's another thing that you need to meditate on. You know, what if you don't feel good about yourself, what is the state of your friendships? Because you can't isolate your sense of well-being from yourself from other people. We're social beings. Human beings are profoundly social. We might go into solitary retreats or whatever, but we're profoundly social, deeply affected by other people. And if our relationships with other people aren't as they could be, well, you need to do something about it. You need to sort it out. Particularly, you need to embrace loving kindness more and more and more. You know, very often, people get sort of slightly dogmatic about the Metta Bhavana, where you can't move on from the first stage until you really love yourself. You know, remember what somebody saying that they, you know, because they didn't love themselves, they spent 50 minutes doing it to themselves and then wonder why they were more and more miserable. Well, I can tell you, if you spend 50 minutes just thinking about yourself, it's a recipe for misery. You know, I mean, apart from anything else, it's incredibly boring. I often find I might be quite dry in the first stage. Soon as I think of a friend, a good friend, I'm loving. And when you love, you're happy. When you love, you're happy. There's no question about it. Sometimes the first stage of the Metta Bhavana comes after the second stage. When you love, you're happy. So if you have difficulties thinking well about yourself, maybe you're not expressing love enough. So really think about these things. Really tune up to that sense of well-being and really tune into this very, very precious human existence. And of course, the tradition says this is the best possible condition to gain enlightenment. Vajrayana Buddhism, which Milarepa comes from, the body itself, the human embodiment, is nothing other than a temple of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So hopefully we'll be seeing something about that as we go on. This is Buddhahood, this very body. It's sacred. And in the Vajrayana, the doing any damage to the human embodiment, oneself or others, is extremely serious. Extremely serious, because you're destroying the Buddha. Vajrayana is connected as well with Buddha nature traditions. It's sometimes said that Buddha nature traditions are connected very strongly with vegetarianism, that if you eat meat, you're killing the Buddha, because you're killing the Buddha potential. Very interesting, which isn't often, that connection isn't often made. But anyway, the main point is really, really valuing our very, very precious human existence and human individuality, and really making the most of it. This can be, of course, doesn't have to be incredibly, I know sometimes people, when they talk about, you sometimes get this thing where people are quite self-indulgent with their sense experience, and they often say, I'm being kind to myself. I'm being kind to myself. Well, they're not necessarily doing that, actually. There's no need to rationalise indulgence in very strong sense experience by being kind to yourself. But I'm struck by this, because Milarepa, some people might say he's giving himself a hard time. Listen to the way he describes his happiness. What's happened is that, this is later on in his life in the mountains, some hunters have come across him, and they describe him as being, that there's nobody more miserable and pitiable than him, because he lives in this cave, he looks like a ghost, he's gone the colour green from all the nettles he's consumed, and he's got nothing but his thin robe. And this is what he says: a small rigid cushion beneath me, happiness. A soft cotton robe around me, happiness. A meditation belt wrapped around me, happiness. Illusory body, neither hungry nor full, happiness. Mind that gives up examination, happiness. I am not unhappy. Happy is what I am. If I seem happy, so happy. Do all I have done. If you don't have the fortune to practice the Dharma, spare me your mistaken pity. For I am the one who accomplishes lasting happiness for myself and all sentient beings. Wonderful little extract. So it's not about, giving yourself treats to enjoy happiness and this precious human existence. It's about getting down to a much more meaningful and simple existence, and really enjoying the basics of things. So Milarepa understands the preciousness of human life. But this precious human life isn't given us for very long, is it? So the next reflection, very important reflection, is on death and impermanence. We have this precious human life for a limited time. In fact, we don't even know when we will die. Death could come at any moment, at any time. So we need, as well as to meditate on the preciousness of human existence, we then need, it naturally follows, you wake up to your precious human existence, and then quite naturally you reflect, yes, but this precious human existence will come to an end. And there is no telling when I will find that precious human existence again, especially the precious human existence where I can practice the Dharma and I have all these conditions for practicing the Dharma. I will die. So you have these reflections in the Tibetan tradition again and again. Three root meditations on death. First of all, you have to convince yourself that you will die. That you will die. I know this sounds terribly obvious, and we all say, oh yeah, I'm going to die. But we're talking about this, taking this down into the depths again, and really knowing it in our blood and our bones. I will die. It's not if, it's when. I will die. I am growing older, and I will die. Shantideva has those wonderful lines. Night and day, my life advances to destruction. I must surely die. And it's on the basis of that reflection that he goes for refuge. So this very day, I go for refuge. This very day, I go for refuge. That verse comes out of a keen awareness of the inevitability of death. Nobody cheats death. The Buddha doesn't cheat death. Nobody gets around it. It's a fact, which we can't ignore. The next reflection, the second reflection, and death can come at any time. Death can come at any time. Nobody can predict when they will die. Even the Buddha can't predict when somebody dies. Death will strike at any moment. Could be a terrible illness, accident, anything. In the tradition they talk about, you might be cursed by demons. They're very fond of that in the Tibetan tradition. Some terrible illness of one kind or another. So this is really, really striking, and they're really getting this into view. And of course, this is why we've got to be in a very, very positive state of mind. Why metta bhavana and faith and devotion and being strongly connected with the Buddha Dharma, strongly connected with spiritual friends, is so important. So that we can bring in this shocking truth. We have to do this because, you know, it can be that when you start to contemplate death, you can end up becoming quite depressed and nihilistic. You can think, well, what's the point? What's the point of doing anything? It's, nothing is of any value. Nothing is worthwhile. The tradition says, no, that is a wrong insight into death and impermanence. That isn't an insight at all. That's a wrong understanding. It should actually heighten your experience. It should make your experience more and more vivid. More and more vivid. This is one of the very striking things about Milarepa's life. Someone who knows profoundly the fact of death. And yet, his appreciation of life is so extraordinarily vivid. So extraordinarily vivid. I'm running out of time, unfortunately, but I was going to read you, this wonderful song about impermanence, which begins with just these similes: a painting in gold, flowers of turquoise blue, floods in the veil above, rice in the veil below, abundance of silk, a jewel of value, the crescent moon, and a precious sun. And he goes on, the gold painting fades when it is completed. This shows the illusory nature of all beings. This proves the transient nature of all things. Think, then you will practice Dharma. Elegant silken cloth, soon with a knife is cut. This shows the illusory nature of all beings. This proves the transient nature of all things. Think, then you will practice Dharma. Maybe we can have this sometime in the puja. So very vivid, keen awareness of kind of ordinary things, but also this keen awareness of their illusory, impermanent nature. They arise, they pass. And of course, he's using that as a simile for our own body itself, this illusory body, illusory in the sense that it's always changing. We're always changing. And at some point, that change will be, as it were, final with death. So we need to wake up to this. And the tradition then says, the third great reflection, at the time of death, the only thing of any value is Dharma. The only thing of any value is Dharma. Friends are not going to be any good to you at that time. Lovers, wives, sons, family, computers, not they had them in those days, but you know, all the things, all the gadgets with which we surround ourselves, useless to us. Yes, maybe there'll be good friends and good people around us to help us at the end. But when we go into that night, we are on our own. We are on our own, and it doesn't end. It doesn't end. It's not just a blank, according to the tradition. We're going into something, and we need some ballast. We need some provisions. We need to have internalized the guru. We need to have internalized the teaching. We need to have it with us. We need to be resourceful. We need to be curious. In the Bardo Tadol, the guide is saying, reading to you, telling you, you have died. Death has come. Because you're in denial about it. You, after death, according to Tibetan tradition, you're trying to run around. The spirit is trying to run around convincing everybody, I'm not dead, I'm here. I'm here. It's like a terrible nightmare, but it's real. Nobody's listening. And they're all doing the death rituals wrong. It's making you really seriously pissed off because you're not going to get a good rebirth because of that.
How do you know?
Pardon?
How do you know?
Well, it's what the tradition says.
Imagination.
No. This is what the tradition says.
And, okay.
Well, the thing is, it's true because we're in denial now. We're in denial now about the reality of death and impermanence. That's the thing. That's why it's true. It's worth reflecting on that. Are we really awake to what's happening now with ourselves? So, yes, after death we're on our own, and you need the Dharma, even if it's not the way it's described in the tradition. I personally don't want to be going into that moment in denial, pretending it's not happening, or being so overwhelmed with horror at the loss of embodiment that I don't know what to do. At least I want to be curious. At least I want to know a way of working with what is actually happening. And the only way that I'm going to do that is if I know how to work now. This is why meditation is so important. Sangharakshita says, death is a state of enforced meditation. Because all your sense experience is swept away. So the more you can get used to being with the expanded consciousness, not dependent on sense experience. The more you can get used to working with that, the more you're going to make sense of the senses receding at the time of death. So make the most of it. Make the most of it now. It's also worth just looking at it in terms of aging. Again, if that death is a bit of a mystery to you and you're not convinced by that, if you're younger, and we're all relatively young, it's worth reflecting. Age affects us very, very strongly. It becomes harder to practice as you get older. In some ways it gets easier because, you know, certain things have sort of calmed down through maturity. But on the other hand, you get less adventurous as you get older, or some people do. Much less, you get much more concerned about comfort, much more concerned about safety. You see it. And less, you know, and you start getting more and more habitual, you start getting more and more fixed. The Buddha has a wonderful line in the Dhammapada. Let me just find it for you, just to rub it in. For some of us who are aging. Those who have not led the spiritual life, or obtained the wealth of merit in their youth, such as these brood over the past like aged herons in a pond without fish. So let's not be these herons in a pond without fish. Very sad state of affairs. You know, we're just brooding over the past. There's nothing to eat now. It's all gone. Those who have not led the spiritual life or obtained the wealth of merit in their youth, such as these lie like worn out arrows, lamenting the things of old. I really like that one, because when you're young, you're like an arrow, aren't you? You know, you're shooting ahead. You know, you're in the battle. You've got tremendous purpose. You're going forward. Well, it's tragic if you haven't really worked on yourself and developed yourself and you just become a spent arrow, and all there is just nostalgia for the old days. There's nothing more boring to listening to sort of aging, you know, aging people talking about their old rock and roll days. You know, there's nothing more sort of boring than that. And, you know, hopefully there's nothing more, you know, it's not the same with, you know, old Buddhists going on about the old days, the good old days, you know, when we were young and they're not doing anything now. We don't want to be like that. So the point of this reflection on death and the fact that death, you know, can come at any time is to get on with it. It's to really get on with it. I've said this a few times. I actually don't care whether or not people become Buddhists or not, or become ordained. Well, I do. But from another point of view, I don't care. What I really want people to do is to live a fulfilled life, a really meaningful life. And if you're in, what I'm trying to get at here, if you're in perpetual, chronic doubt about what you're doing with your life, for goodness sake, do something about it, because life is too short and too precarious and too precious to waste your time in indecision. Don't get to 60 and think, well, what have I done? You know, you also get people, you know, who have so much potential. They can do this, they can do that. I could be a novelist, I could be an artist, I could have a family, I could be a meditator, I could be a Buddhist. I was talking to somebody the other day about all the different things they might be doing, and you know, I was really tempted to quote Sandra Rachter, if you're not careful, you end up with somebody with a really great future behind them. So don't be somebody with a really great future behind you. You know, do it now. Doesn't matter in a sense what it is, so long as it's skillful and creative. But really live the life you want to live. And then the third thought that turns the mind to Dharma is really meditating on the causes and effects of actions. This is the law of karma. This is the fundamental Buddhist insight, actually. Not self, all those things. They're not, I don't think they're particularly important, really. I think the really important insight is into karma. That our intentional actions have effects. That if we're acting out of greed, hatred and delusion, that will cause suffering for ourselves and others. If we're acting out of contentment and generosity, non-hatred, love, wisdom, understanding, seeing into the nature of things, faith, good will come for ourselves and others. This is so basic. But this is what Milarepa realizes in retreat. And when he says later about protecting the precepts that he takes, as guarding them as if they were like his own eyes. You know, we know how precious our sight is, and we really protect our eyes from any harm. He's saying we need to have the same attitude to the precepts that we take, because of this business of the way karma works, that actions have consequences. And of course, the more you see that your positive intentions and actions are having this very, very positive effect, you become more and more confident in the Dharma. You become more and more confident in the spiral conditionality. You know, the growth of growing and developing along the path. And actually, that is insight into emptiness and not self. Insight into emptiness and not self is not into some sort of a vacuum, but it's into the dynamic nature of life, and particularly it's that positive aspect of growth along the path, the maturing aspect of the spiritual life, the expansive nature of Dharma life. So really get hold of that, Milarepa is telling us. And then the fourth, and in some ways the again, well, they're all equally important, aren't they? It is meditating on the faults of samsara. This is one that we really underestimate. You know, in expositions of the four thoughts that turn the mind to the Dharma, this is one that we don't really pay attention to. It's really trying to see into the all-pervasive dukkha of of this world, of samsara. Doesn't mean that, as we've seen, that you can't enjoy vividly the beauty of existence, the vivid nature of life, and when you see the transient nature of things, it does become incredibly vivid to you. It doesn't mean that you can't love and you can't appreciate and you can't, you know, value the good things in life. One of the things that's really wonderful about the Tibetans is how earthy they are, and they seem to really enjoy earthy kind of pleasures of life. And yet, because they're so soaked, the great practitioners are so soaked in the tradition, they also see the limitations of that life. They see its, they see its dukkha, and it's very important to meditate on dukkha. Otherwise, our Buddhism becomes a way of adjusting ourselves to samsara. You know, I've often quoted this, I don't mind quoting it again, seeing that lecture by that very strange Slovenian philosopher, Zizek, I think, I'm not sure how you say it, where he is critical of Western Buddhism. Because he says Western Buddhism is a perfect fit with global capitalism. He obviously doesn't know about Tri Ratna, but he was listening to a CEO from one of the big global, you know, companies. I don't know who it was, who was saying, you know, it's brilliant. You know, shunyata, emptiness, is brilliant for us. It's brilliant if you're, you know, for running a business, because that's the marketplace. It's insubstantial. It's constantly changing. So the more you tune into emptiness, the more you can make more money. It's absolute travesty of Buddhism. Absolute travesty of the Dharma. Total black magic. Turning, you know, the Dharma into something really black. You know, that you get something, you know, for yourself and to do with your ambition. But there's a lot of that. You know, there's lots of applied Buddhism, which no doubt has a very positive effect. Jolly good that people using Buddhist think, well, things derived from Buddhist practices to alleviate stress and depression and all the rest of it. That's great. Anything that alleviates people's suffering is a good thing, but it's not the Dharma. It's not what Milarepa's about. It's not what the Buddha is about. There is a seeing through of everything. So it's worth, you know, you sometimes sort of see it with people coming to the movement, that they come along because of a lot of suffering. That really motivates them. They get themselves together through Buddhist practice. Great. They become more integrated through mindfulness. They become more positive through metta bhavana. They've got a good group of friends now and all the rest of it. They're sort of going for it. And then they think, great, I can handle myself now in samsara. Well, in some ways, that's a good thing. Be a healthy human being. But then they go real go for it. Stop meditating. And, well, who knows what happens. Sometimes they can kind of make it work on its own terms, or sometimes not. Either way, they stop on the path. They stop on the path. They don't push on. They haven't seen into the nature of things deeply enough. So we need to meditate on the three dukkhas, the three aspects of suffering. First of all, dukkha, the fact of suffering. You know, this isn't just ordinary physical pain. This is the fact that this embodiment is shot through with suffering. It's not personal. It hits you personally, but it actually comes to everybody. The insight into dukkha, by the way, when you have a real insight into it, it might be delivered to you very personally, but the insight into dukkha is its universality. It's not just about you. It's about everybody. Sentient beings, infinite as the sky in number, are like one's own father and mother, although desirous of happiness, because of ignorance and unskillfulness, they do evil and therefore they suffer. What a pity. So it's not just, that's from a bodhicitta practice. It's about waking up to the all-pervasive nature of dukkha That goes with the territory. There's no use complaining, oh, I'm suffering. No, this is the nature of things. So start learning from that. Learning from that pain. Learning from that dukkha. That's the thing about dukkha. It's there in the Buddha's teaching to make you question. Make you question why you're living this life, what this life is, what you're going to do with this life. And then, of course, there's viparinama dukkha, the dukkha that comes through change. So even wonderful things that you're enjoying will transform into their opposite. That's the nature of things. And therefore, there's this kind of unease, this kind of angst. You know, this angst that pervades the modern world. You know, people are trying to sort of treat it with drugs or a bit of relaxation or a bit of mindfulness. It's there because people know that things are impermanent. They know it isn't going to last. So the desperation of getting what you can to get through. And yet people know underneath it all, there's this awareness of impermanence. That you can't have it forever. You can't hold on to it. And yet people are pretending to do that. So you've got to engage with that. So again, back to the truth of impermanence. The only way you're going to deal with that angst, the only way you're going to relax into deep, deep serenity is through really fully accepting the flow of change, the flow of existence. And again, doing something about it, changing the way you live. And then even if you feel serene about that, even if you're feeling very, very good with the world, there is sankhara dukkha or khanda dukkha, the suffering of conditioned existence itself. You know, this very, very structure of self and other, of embodiment, of coming together, that in itself is painful. No matter how far you go in dhyana, you know, even to the most exalted Arupa Dhyana that the Buddha did, you still have this sense, if you're a real practitioner, of dissatisfaction. Because even a subtle sense of self and other, therefore a sense of grasping and clinging and restriction, is there, holding you back. And it's only with Buddhahood, only with the complete dissolution of grasper and grasped, self and other, and the complete flooding forth of completely spontaneous love and compassion, endless love and compassion, that you arrive at the end of suffering, that you arrive at Nibbanam Paramang Sukham. Nibbana is the supreme bliss, the supreme satisfaction. So those are the four thoughts that turn the mind to the Dharma that Milarepa understands in his retreat. This talk has gone on far too long, but I do want to end with a bit more Milarepa and this business of this. One of the things that Milarepa says, that when you see the faults of samsara, when you've meditated on and understood these four mind-turning reflections, you feel an endless, profound longing to leave life's round. This is the meaning of renunciation. This is the meaning of going forth. Renunciation and going forth, I regard as the shadow of Buddhism all over the world. I say it's the shadow of Buddhism because I think we don't like to look at it. We don't like to look at it. You know, the founder of our tradition left home. The founder of our tradition was a homeless wanderer. He never went back home, even after enlightenment. I'm not saying, by the way, everybody should leave their families. Don't get me wrong. Please don't misunderstand. The fact of the matter is, renunciation is intrinsic and essential to Buddhism. We have to find a relationship with it. We have to find an understanding of how that relates to our life, what that means for our spiritual practice. Renunciation and going forth is the other side of going for refuge to the Buddha and Dharma and Sangha. Milarepa really is someone who experiences this tremendous longing to leave samsara and to no longer rely upon it. After he comes out of this 11-month retreat, he goes into another long retreat, and in that retreat he has a dream, a very vivid dream. And it's a dream about his home, his house all broken down. He dreams that his mother is dead. He dreams that his sister is begging. And he feels this tremendous, well, sense of upset and concern and love. You know, you can also relate it, I think, to his bodhisattva vow. You know, the fact is that his mother is who he's closest to. His sister is who he's closest to. So he wants to know what's happened to them. Even though he's gone forth from them, even though he's left them behind, he needs to go back. So he breaks his retreat. He goes to Marpa, tells him what has happened, and Marpa says, yes, you must go. And he decides to leave, and Marpa gives final teachings, initiations, and blessings. And Marpa says, this will be the last time you will ever see me. This is an extraordinary sort of moment. Doesn't say why, but this is the end of you seeing me in the flesh. This is you now going out, going forth, going out on your own to make your way. Very, very interesting way of describing this. And he goes back. Milarepa finds his way to his homeland. He's got to hide, of course, because he's got to kind of go anonymously, because, you know, he can't escape the effect of his actions of being a black magician. Everybody in his region hates him. He knows he's going to be in real trouble. So even though he's purified himself in relation to enlightenment, doesn't mean he's escaped the effect of things in relation to other people. That's a whole topic in itself. And he finds his home, and he finds a pile of bones in the home, and he realizes it's his mother's bones. He finds the old texts that they used to recite, and they're all eaten up by mice and have mice droppings all over them. And he realizes that he's overwhelmed. He's overwhelmed with sorrow at the nature of samsara. In a way, he does take it very, very personally. The loss of his father, the loss of his mother, the loss of his home, the loss of his fields. It is personal. But from another point of view, it isn't. It's just a symptom of this life. It's a symptom of attachment. And it's a symptom of what happens when you lose what you love. It's a very, very interesting, kind of complex, almost set of emotions that Milarepa has. Tremendous sorrow at the loss of all this, but also insight into the nature of this very life. Extraordinary. And I'm going to read to you the song that he sings and just before that, and what he decides to do in relation to what he's found. I gathered together my mother's bones and the Ratnakuta texts. I pay homage to them, having cleansed them of the dust and burn droppings. The books were not too damaged by the rain and could still be read. I loaded the first part of the text onto my back and carried my mother's bones in the fold of my cloak. Feeling immeasurable weariness towards the world, I became certain that samsara had no essence. Overcome with immeasurable sorrow, I sang this song of my fervent pledge to fulfill the essential purpose of the Dharma. Lord Akshobhya, in essence, compassionate one, O Marpa the translator, in accord with your prophecy, here in the demonic prison of my homeland, I find the gurus, impermanence and illusion. Bless me, that I may absorb the truth offered by these gurus. All things that exist or appear are impermanent and unstable. They change and they move, and especially this world of samsara has no essential purpose and value. Rather than engage in futile actions, I must devote myself to the essential purpose of the Dharma. At first, when there was a father, there was no son. When there was a son, there was no longer a father. Our meeting was illusion. I, the son, will practice the holy Dharma. To horse tooth white rock, I go to meditate. When there was a mother, there was no son. Now that I have come home, my old mother is dead. Our meeting was illusion. I, the son, will practice the holy Dharma. To horse tooth white rock, I go to meditate. When there was a sister, there was no brother. Now that her brother has come home, she has wandered away. Our meeting was illusion. I, the son, will practice the holy Dharma. To horse tooth white rock, I go to meditate. When there were Dharma texts, there was no one to venerate them. Now that I venerate them, they are damaged by rain. Our meeting was illusion. I, the son, will practice the holy Dharma. To horse tooth white rock, I go to meditate. When there was a house, there was no master. Now that the master has come, it is in ruins. Our meeting was illusion. I, the son, will practice the holy Dharma. To horse tooth white rock, I go to meditate. When there was a fertile field, there was no master. Now that the master has come, it is overgrown with weeds. Our meeting was illusion. I, the son, will practice the holy Dharma. To horse tooth white rock, I go to meditate. Homeland, house, fields and the like, the things of the world have no essence at all. Let the ignorant take them. I, a yogi, go in search of liberation. Compassionate Father, Marpa the translator, bless your son that he may meditate in solitude.